This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 268 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
This episode is part of our Drums of Autumn, our ever-dwindling Drums of Autumn read-along. And before we get started, just a little invitation. We would like to invite you to join us in the magical world of Scotland next spring on our 2019 Pod Abroad tour. We have a fabulous tour set up, hoping to rock the socks off of last year's even. And our leaving dinner is gonna be pretty sweet. It's gonna be at Hopetoun House, which is where, I mean, actually Hopetoun House stood in for a ton of stuff in the show in every season thus far. But we're gonna be having dinner in the Red Room of the Duke's home, the Duke of Sandringham. So for more information about that, you can find out everything at podabroad.com. That's podabroad.com. We hope that you will join us, and we can't wait to see you there.
And now on to our read-along. This week, we are continuing, as you stated, our ever-dwindling Drums of Autumn read-along. We have four chapters this week, though we will get started with chapter 61, entitled The Office of a Priest. And I don't know about you guys, but it's getting real hard to stop reading when we reach the end of our assignments. Because there's so much behind us and so little ahead of us, you want to just, you know, push through. And it's hard to stop. But I stopped.
It wasn't that hard for her to stop. She made me stop early.
No, that's not why. I didn't make you stop early to stop reading. I made you stop early to stop taking notes. It wasn't that I didn't want to continue reading. It was that I realized how long of an episode it was going to be if we continued through more chapters.
In case you saw my tweet, in case you're following Summer and I on our personal Twitter accounts, I'm at bookishginge, B-O-O-K-I-S-H-G-I-N-G-E. No R. Summer is at Summer Ray. Okay, so at bookishginge tonight. Just before we started to record, I took a little, I guess, what do you call it? A pep nap? A power nap. A pep nap. I am making up words like I never do. But I'm making up things like all day today. So I took a little power nap, maybe 20-ish minutes, and I woke up before the alarm went off that I set, as almost always happens. And I felt all this wetness against my face. And I was like, what the? I was curled up with a cat, and I'm like, what did she get into? And I realized
she got
into you.
She got into your mouth.
Okay, stop it. That's disgusting. No, I drooled. I don't know when it started, but probably soon after I fell asleep. I woke up. I would have woken up if I were on a floor, like a hardwood floor, I would have woken up in a puddle of drool. Since my cat was next to / underneath my face.
And moderately absorbent.
This is funny.
I'll be the judge of that.
Cats' hair, and this is why I'm not going to get into the medicinal stuff of it or the veterinary stuff of it. I have worked and I work with a DMV. I work with a DMV. Thank you very much. I work with a DVM. I work with a vet trained in Western medicine and also who does her own research at her own medical hospital it's a hospital. That's her business name. On the efficacy of various essential oils or blends on how they stop different types of diseases, how they fix different types of diseases. That's a whole other conversation. I'm not trying to get into. Anyway.
Too late.
One of the things I learned from that vet is that if you're going to apply safe oils to, say, a cat, you don't have to, like, drown them with it. You use very little and you just have to, like, put it on your hand and then you can, like, wipe them. You can, like, pet them, backwards or forwards. But the thing about a cat's fur, and I don't know about a dog's, I'm guessing the same with the dog, is that cat's fur wicks like a bitch. It's like a little wick. You put something on the outside, that stuff is sucked up into the whatevers. I just scared my cat. I'm sorry, baby. So anyway, I'm just saying all that, like, no, my drool was not sucked into her skin, I hope. But oh no, whatever was presented to the top of her fur made it to the bottom of her fur and all around. So I am winning tonight. So let's go. So we are in Snake Town. This is back with the Mohawk. Claire is being escorted to a longhouse guarded by two men. Diana describes a death song that Claire hears. And she enters the longhouse, and this, of course, is where Jamie and Roger are. Now, this line made me laugh. Quote, Jamie's rumpled head popped up, unquote. It's like Diana had described like a pile of, like two piles, and between the two piles of clothing or of plaid, of tartan, like Jamie's rumpled head pops up in the middle of these two piles, and then it made me laugh. Anyway, and then she sees Roger, quote, a dark bearded man who seemed oddly familiar. Then he moved into the light, and I caught. It's going to be a rough one, Summer.
Gonna be.
And I caught the flash of green eyes above the shrubbery. Unquote. Claire asks Roger if he's all right, and he asks immediately if Bree's all right. She starts to tell him where she is, where Bree is, and who she's with. And Jamie interrupts and says, Sasnak, my arm might be broken. Will you come to tend to it? Smooth move there, Jamie. Of course he wants her away from Roger so they can chat first. Claire knew this, quote, went after him. Claire knew this and, quote, went after him, wondering what the hell. Jamie wouldn't admit to being in pain in front of Roger Wakefield. He says he hasn't told him about Bree and doesn't think she should either, at least not about Bonnet. He continues, he says, not yet, not here. Let's get away safely.
Yeah, he's like, you don't get to tell him that. I get to tell him that later when we're on the trail out of here. I get to yell it at him in a fit of rage because that's the appropriate time to tell him.
She goes back to Roger and she lets it slip on purpose that Bree is pregnant. He had to know about something, meaning he knew that there was something fishy going on or that all was not right because the looks everyone was giving each other, the way Jamie had been with him when it was just the two of them, there's something going on that they didn't tell him.
Well, and there had to be a reason that she didn't come too.
Oh, totally. Yeah, exactly. He's already suspected something is wrong. He says, are you sure? Claire says, she'll be 7 months gone by now. It's noticeable.
Right.
Roger goes, pregnant? But how?
Like,
it just gets better.
It's like everyone forgets how to English when you get in a situation.
Stop. Yeah, I thought you were making fun of me at first. Oh, gosh.
No. How? Really? Because it's not what he meant. You know what I mean?
No, it's of like, course not. It's just like, what the heck? Then Jamie joins in on the fun. Quote, you didn't think, and it's my daughter left to pay the price of your pleasure, unquote. Roger says, no, she's my wife. And he tells him that they're handfast. And Jamie says, out loud, but maybe more to himself than to anyone else, why could the lass not have told us, though?
Which is what everyone has wondered about every interaction in this book that could have easily been solved with a conversation. Why didn't she tell me? Why didn't he tell me? Why did no one say he was going by Mackenzie?
Oh, no. Of course, she not said anything because she wanted Roger to have an out if he wanted it. And they realized that.
Well, he almost got more than an out.
He almost got out of life.
Right.
Oh, gosh. At Claire's words, quote, she wanted to come with us, unquote, Roger's response is heartbreaking. She wanted to come? His face lighted up, joy and relief plain to see, even through the hair and filth. Make something so beautiful and so sad and so poignant, so comical. Even through the shrubbery.
Right. Okay, so I can... Stars went full method when casting Richard Rankin. Oh, Lord, did Richard. You see the picture that he posted earlier this week on Facebook? Not Facebook. It was on Twitter. It was his calves with these stripy socks on. And
he's a hairy dude.
So hairy. Like,
he's a bear.
Real hairy. Like, yeah. And I don't know. I've never looked at his legs prior to that picture with any detail, I should say. But after having read the last few chapters and all of the discussions, all of the discussions of just how like hairy he is comparatively, that picture last week was pretty appropriately timed.
I wonder if they're going to
shave his legs. No,
no, no. Wax his chest.
Why would they wax his chest?
I'm not saying they should. I don't know. Don't they? Sam does not get waxed. That's right. He purposely keeps the short and curlies on his chest because that's, what do you call it? It's called method, but that's natural. Okay. Sorry. That was a tangent, but not really. Claire and Jamie admit that the whole beating and selling him to the Mohawk was a misunderstanding.
Yeah. So super sorry about that, dude.
Right? And then, where's Ian? Where's Ian, dudes? Claire said that she hadn't seen him. So where had Claire been all night? But then she's about to explain herself. And then she sees Roger's foot and she goes on a full doctor mode. And the way she describes it is disgustable.
I mean, it's clearly infected. Ugh. And she's like, I could feel the pocket of yuck underneath it. Like there was pus pockets and blah.
Yes, that's what I mean. Have you ever had anything on your body anywhere? You don't have, if it's in a place that you don't want to talk about, you can fake it. Have you ever had anything on your body where it's like either a cut or an injury, something that wasn't so bad that you couldn't operate without getting it, you know, looked at or whatever, or you just took a long time to get it looked at. But by the time you did get it looked at, because it wasn't oozing or anything, you had like pockets of pus under the skin?
No. I mean, I had blood poisoning once in my foot, but I don't remember it.
Is that when you were itty bitty?
Yeah.
Okay. So the only time I've had anything like this, and it's not like I was escaping my captors or anything, trying to, because he failed. It was, honestly, I didn't have a puncture. That's what's so weird. I didn't have any puncture or anything like Roger had. Or a cut. A few years ago, I was walk jogging, you know, much more actively. 2013, I think. Anyway, and... No, 2014. And I had a pair of shoes on. The shoes fit. I mean, they probably were too old, but they fit. And I walked, jogged this, I think a 5K. And I was with our mom. And she like walked part of it and then just went back to the place where you start, where you can go back. You don't have to finish. You can go back at any time. She went back to the starting place like pretty quickly. And then I just walked, jogged the rest of the way and I met her at the end. Well, my toe was feeling kind of weird. It didn't hurt, but it felt kind of weird. And what I learned from this experience is, ladies and gentlemen, trim your bloody toenails, especially your big toenails. My toenail was not trimmed enough, or it had been too long since I had trimmed it. And so I went and not just like walked in these shoes, like I pushed myself on and off. I did walk, jog. But when I jogged, I like pushed myself. And so in putting all that pressure, every time my foot went down, even though I wasn't landing on my toes, my toes would, you know, go toward the front of my shoe. And because my toenail was too long, again, it didn't hurt badly in the moment. It just felt like, it's okay, well, I need to trim them. It kept banging the end of the shoe. And so by the time I was done, like, I was a little muscularly sore, but mostly I was like, my foot feels weird. I don't know what this is. That was in July. A week or less later, I noticed that the toe of that foot was like, the toenail was like kind of purplish, and I was like, that's really weird. And by this time I had trimmed my toenail, but by that time it's too late. So I thought, oh well, if it's purple, it'll just, you know, it'll take 6 months, but this toenail will ultimately grow out and my nail will be white or clear again. And it was, except the pain never went away. The pain is like this deep throbbing ache, and it ended up in the corner, the top left corner of the toenail. Fast forward, remember I said July. Fast forward to the next January. I'm like, I had it. It hurt so bad. If I like touched it, it hurt. So I went to the doctor and she right away referred me to a podiatrist, and I had an ingrown toenail and I had to have it surgically removed, which, you know, they don't put you out. It's a whole experience that I will not discuss. But anyway, when I went to my GP and she just looked at my toe and like was just pressing on it lightly. Oh my God. It hurts so bad. And she's like, oh yeah, you have an infection in there. And I'm like, excuse me, what? She's like, oh yeah, that pushy stuff, the stuff you can feel this, that's pus.
So hot.
I was like, are you kidding me? This has been since July. So that was a long developing one. It was gross, but not as gross as Roger's. So then Roger comes clean and tells them what they fought over, what he and Brianna actually fought over. They already know about the death notice. Now, Jamie mentions that due to the death notice, he felt comfortable bringing Claire with him to get Roger because they would both be alive for a few more years still. A few more years yet. Still, this is a little scary. It's something that he calls practical immortality. Now, Sam, if you knew that you weren't, maybe you didn't know the day or the way. Oh, that rhymed. I like that. Would you be a little less cautious in certain things if you knew you'd be around for a bit?
Yes and no.
The yes I get. What's the no? I mean, the no I get. Sorry,
because
I'm so backwards.
While, you know, you may not die because that's not your death day, it doesn't mean that you're not going to make the rest of your time here on Earth fest by some choices. So I think there are some things I might be a little less cautious with, but I'm not going to lose all caution. Like I said, I want to enjoy my remainder of my time here.
So Roger believes the past cannot be changed, and that's why he did it. What? He explains how he found the notice before Bree did, and that's why he kept it from her. The past couldn't be changed, he believes. He was afraid if she found it, she'd think it could be, and of course, flee back to help change it. And of course, that's what she did. He had tried everything he could do to keep her from going back. And in this moment, this is the first time, y'all, Jamie finally has some respect for Roger. He's like, you understand, you get it, you're trying to protect her. And Roger's like, yes. Claire does not share Jamie's sentiments, however, but Jamie brings some levity. He understands that he would never have met his daughter if she hadn't come back. But what's happened to her, not just the pregnancy, but the rape mostly, also wouldn't have happened. Oopsie. He almost let that one out. He doesn't mention the rape, but it almost comes out. Roger caught it. He's like, oh, you mean her being pregnant? And then he realizes she can't go back to the stones. Claire said she tried to get her to go back earlier and tells Roger about the opening in the Indies. The stones at Abandawe. Oh, God. Abandawe? I don't even know.
And they said Abandawe.
Whatever comes out,
Abandawe in the series.
The stinking. See, I can handle, I mean, to greater and lesser degrees, with greater and lesser degrees of grace, I admit. But I can handle changes, twists, adaptation things that may not be my favorite. But dude, pronunciation of things, I'm not blaming. I'm just like, ugh, when you've heard it for 20 freaking years or thereabouts, it's very hard to change, truly, because this, you just heard me, I just fought with myself over it, and myself did it. No one wins when I fight with myself, because I'm just confused. Okay, she tells him about the opening in the Indies, but that she wouldn't go back. And Jamie's beating of Roger had been the thing that had trapped Bree in the past. He can only hope to remedy it by bringing him back to her, of course, Jamie. Claire realizes that's why he didn't want to tell Roger anything. Quote, for fear that when he realized Brianna was trapped in the past, Waja would with you.
Wow.
Summer, I haven't even gotten barely past page two. Shoot.
See, and this Roger, is the problem.
You guys, I'm not drunk, I promise. I'm just sleep drunk. Schlaftrunken. Schlafbetrunken. Is that a word?
No.
I'm sure it is. Roger would refuse to come back with us. Following her into the past was one thing. Staying there forever with her was something else again. Unquote. Then a large number of Mohawks entered the hut. There are about 15 of them, men, women, and children. and they were dressed for traveling. One woman with a cradleboard handed it to Roger. She wanted him to baptize the baby. So Fromage had said that Roger was a priest. This is the group of what was left of the priest's flock. And they have been told by the tribe that they must leave.
Can his theme song be Son of a Preacher Man?
Oh, Lord. That's pretty fitting.
I think so.
When was it written? Do you know?
Like the 60s.
Really?
I think so. Let me see.
Check it out, because totally. If so, that would be amazing.
1969.
And they went back in 68? I mean, it doesn't mean it's not appropriate. It just may not. He may not have heard it. Jamie says, quote, in case of need, any man may do the office of priest. Unquote. Roger freaks, but recovers, and then goes on in French, and he baptizes the girl, Alexandra. Man, that baptism scene gave me all kinds of tear pricks, and I hadn't expected that. I'm sure I had all the feels every time I read it, but holy doly. Did you, or were you a robot?
I mean, I was driving when it happened, so I was moving.
I got it. I see how we are. After this, they were brought some food and wood for the fire. Claire continues her account of the night before. She assures them, no, they're not going to kill us. She had spent the night with a council of mothers. After the ceremony and discussion, they told her that some of the men had found the whiskey cache, brought it to the village, and started to drink. The women thought that a bargain had already been made. And then they started to argue just before the fire was lit to execute Fromage. Fighting broke out, and all hell broke loose. A man was killed in the fighting, and they believe that Roger was the one who killed him. But Roger said he doesn't know. I mean, it could have been him, but he didn't know for sure.
Didn't he stab some dude with a pointy stick?
He did two things. When he had the big pointy 6-foot thing, he ran through the door and he knocked someone over. And that person, I think, was just knocked out. He was drunk, but he was knocked out. And then after that, that's when he stabbed someone after that with it. And then he, like, I don't know if it was with the club, with the 6-foot piece of wood, or something else, but I think he beat him up, like beat on him, like his head or something. So they're not going to kill him because their whiskey was basically stolen. So they're saying, look, we got the whiskey and that is the price of his life. But she describes what they sometimes do when an enemy is taken. Sometimes they will adopt them into the tribe for the replacement of the dead person. Hello. But it would have to be a man, so it could not be Claire. Jamie uses his practical mortality logic. He says, it must be me. If I can't die until X date, then they won't hurt me. He would escape as soon as he could go and return to the ridge. He wants Claire and Ian to take Roger back to Brianna. It was midday the next day when they came. This part made me cry. Holy moly. Holy monkey balls. With them was Ian. Quote, his voice sounded odd, breathless, and uncertain. He stepped into the light from the smoke hole, and I gasped, feeling as though I had been punched in the stomach. The hair had been plucked from the sides of his skull. What was left stood up in a thick crest from his scalp, a long tail hanging down his back. One ear had been freshly pierced and sported a silver earring. His face had been tattooed. Double crescent lines of small dark spots, most still scabbed with dried blood, ran across each cheekbone to meet the bridge of his nose. I canna stay long, uncle. I said they must let me come say goodbye. Man, I'm getting a tear prick now. This stuff F's me up. Ooh, this scene.
I was reading. Davina was reading this to me. Mm-hmm. And I just kept thinking about how young Ian of the books was dark. And with the right amount of sun,
He could pass for a native.
From a distance, I would say he could pass. John Bell will never, ever pass.
No, as a matter of fact, his hair will only get lighter.
Right.
Quote, the naming ceremony is tonight. They say after that, I will be Indian, and I must not speak any tongue but the Kanyan Kahaka. I canna speak again in English or the Gaelic. And I ken ye didna have much Mohawk. Ian, ye canna be doing this. I've done it, Uncle Jamie, Ian said softly.
I mean, he's already got face tattoos. And they ripped the hair out of his head. I mean, he's kind of committed, right?
He totally. Then he goes on to ask Claire, oof, oof, oof. Then he goes on to ask Claire to tell Jenny that he will not forget her. He says he think his father will know. Balls, this scene will be dramatic. This is probably a few weeks ago. I said something about how this is like, I think it was the fight between the fight. I don't even know if you call it that. The attack between Ian, Jamie and Roger. I may have said that was the climax of the book. I mean, it's certainly a climax. So I don't know. But I'm thinking like, I know there's so many, and it only gets worse. And by worse, I mean more in number. It only gets worse with each successive book. So it's not really worth, you know, choosing a hill to die on, because the next chapter you'll have another hill. I was about to say that this is a climax. It can't be the climax, but it's definitely a climax of this book. And it's so...
Well, let's put it this way. Because we were dumped back into a brand new world, because colonial America...
A brand new world! Okay.
Colonial America is a totally different world that we're building. A lot of Drums of Autumn, the beginning part of it, was more world building. So there was a lot of exposition and conversations that told you things about the location that had to happen that set the scene for the things that are happening now. So there was a lot of building crescendos to what we are doing now, which is, you know, the end of the book. So, of course, a lot of things happen.
So then he tells them that they can leave in the morning. They won't be stopped. And he apologizes. Oof. He apologizes to Roger for the beating and asks him to take care of Brianna and the child. And then Jamie makes my heart break again. He says, "No, Ian. God, no, lad. Let it be me." Ian smiled, though his eyes were full of tears. I hate Diana sometimes.
You should hate yourself. This is all you.
You shut up. You said to me once that my life wasn't meant to be wasted.
So
said.
It's Jamie's fault.
It won't be. It won't be. He held out his arms and says, "I will not forget you either, Uncle Jamie." Then Diana describes the ceremony. And as we learned a lot from our chat, but specifically regarding this ceremony, we actually didn't learn much except that our friends Rebecca and Toa Honde did confirm that, at least among the Kanyenka Haka, that it was a practice to adopt in. I don't think we spoke specifically about enemies, but it was a practice that they would adopt in outsiders, and that would include whites, I'm guessing, to replace the someone killed. So that was confirmed. They did not confirm the ceremony, and that's not important, but I just thought it would be interesting to note that. So Diana describes the ceremony here of Ian completing his transformation and adoption into the Mohawk tribe. And it didn't seem to be quite the ritual that it would have been historically, but again, they confirmed that people were definitely adopted into tribes. And then finally, we haven't seen or heard from him in a little bit. Rolo is finally mentioned. So that means we're losing Rolo as well. So this sentence slayed me. Quote, "All of the spectators who lined the bank found it hilarious, save the three whites." Unquote. Of course, this is when he's being taken into the river or the creek.
Well, and the dog runs in there and he's like, "Woohoo, it's a game. This is a game."
Exactly. And then came the naming ceremony and they call him Wolf's Brother.
See, he got a cool name. I feel like if I was going to be adopted into a Native American tribe, I would not get a cool name. I don't know what they would call me, but it would not be cool.
Jamie lay his bloodstained tartan across Ian's shoulders and says in Gaelic, "Remember." The next morning, they are on their way. Hi, baby. Yes, hi. The cat who I drooled on is now in my lap. So she forgives me. Roger brings up the other stone circle in the Indies. But Claire's too tired to tell him about Galus. And then he tells them about the one he stumbled into.
I'm just imagining if anyone was going back to try to use the Stone Circle in the West Indies to have to like roll the dead body out of the way. Because they didn't move her. She's still there. And they find that body there, you know.
Oh, that's true.
Hundreds the of bones, years later. Yeah. So anyone who wants to use that portal, you got to step over the remains of Ms. Duncan.
Ms. Duncan. She shows him the opal and on it, the little glyph, and he recognizes the symbol. He tells her it was the glyph from the circle. He says he's been there. Claire gets to thinking about the possibility of sending Bree back anyway, but using Roger's calculations at the distance of the stone circle from the ridge, they'd never make it. Then Jamie says that Roger doesn't have to stay. What? And Claire says, we have to tell him.
Yeah, and here's where Jamie tries to get rid of Roger one last time.
Quote, it may not be your child, unquote.
Dun, dun.
Jamie fills in the blanks, or the blank, whichever, one, two, however many. When Roger left her to go hunting for the gems, she was raped. It was 2 days after they laid together in Wilmington, and it was by Stephen Bonnet. After Jamie attacks him again, Roger pulls out the wee gems he'd gone in search of for their return to the future. Roger says he doesn't know if he'd stay with her, and there's a chance that the child wasn't his. Jamie tells him to go if he doesn't know right then. Right?
No, he did. I just think that that's kind of like...
No, I mean, it's a move.
Yeah, because like, give him a minute.
You just told him.
I'm like, okay, so like what, a few hours ago you said his lady friend is pregnant. And then a couple hours later, we're going to update that status by telling you, oh, and by the way, it might not be yours.
Yeah, it's not.
And nice. Then we're going to take 2 seconds to be like, and if you're not cool with that, you just need to like hit the road. And I'm like, well, I don't even, I'm still digesting the information.
And so Roger tells them to go. He says, if I can, then I'll come. So Jamie and Claire continue on their journey to Bree at River Run, losing another member of their party. Quote, there was nothing behind us but the dark, unquote.
That was chapter 61. Moving on to chapter 62, entitled Three-Thirds of a Ghost, which by my calculations means one whole ghost.
Me too. I was like, wait, huh?
Like, I mean, I'm not fantastic at math, y'all, but I'm pretty good at pie-shaped things.
I thought you were going to say pie hole. I'm like, what?
No.
Pie-shaped things. You mean like pies? Uh-huh. We all like pies, a lot of
and
us.
And if I have 3/3 of a pie, I have a whole pie.
Okay, you're sailing almost, I'm forgetting the character's name.
Mr. Hankey?
Yes. You're sounding very almost Mr. Hankey. Okay, so let's...
That would be my Indian name.
I don't even want to say it. It might be Mistress Hankey. Might be Mistress
Christmas
Hankey.
Turd. It will just be whatever translates to Christmas turd.
The poo in the forest. I don't know. So it's River Run, April 1770. With an opening like that, wow. Quote, they have captured Stephen Bonnet. Unquote. As with many things we've seen or heard of Stephen Bonnet, don't trust anything. Just don't trust it.
I feel like Stephen Bonnet is the Lord John in his sections of Drums of Autumn. Because he just keeps showing up when you least expect it. But instead of bringing fantastic things like, I have an extra ship, take it. Or I'm the governor of Jamaica, I will get you off for murder. He is the dude who shows up and ruins all the things.
Lord John, please work on your delivery of such sensitive tidings when shared with a heavily pregnant woman. After she finds a place to sit, he tells her all about it. He closes the door and sends the slave waiting in the hallway to bed. And finally, this is the first time he's had the chance to see Brianna alone. Let's find out what he means. Bonnet was captured at Cross Creek, charged with smuggling. And once they discovered who he was, other charges were added on. He is condemned and is to hang the next week.
Well, I mean, he's already been sentenced to death. They're just seeing exactly through on the previous yes. the previous sentencing.
While she's taking this in, what's in his head? Lord John is thinking, by God, she is immense.
Didn't he say it out loud, too, like a nerd?
I think he did. That's like put it in quotes. Yeah. No. I quoted it. By God, she was immense. That's not something he would say. He would think it. But he would tell her, you're immense.
But doesn't he have something, doesn't he say something like, it's real? Like, because when he sees the baby move?
At the end of the chapter.
Okay.
She asks for more detail about the date of his hanging and his location. And we're told he's still in Cross Creek. Lord John doesn't know when he'll be moved to Wilmington for execution. And Bree is calculating. She wants to see him. Maybe not the best idea, Brianna. I know it wasn't of the time, but I respect Bree for checking Lord John when he says he's in complete sympathy with her feelings. Quote, no, you aren't. You don't know what my feelings are, unquote. She doesn't want to watch him die. She wants to have a chat. Then Lord John chokes on the alcohol. Quote, maybe you should sit down. You don't look so good, Brianna tells him. She asks him if he can arrange for her to chat with him before he says no, to imagine what she'll do if he does say no. Her leverage for blackmail this time? That she'll announce that Bonnet is the father of her baby to all the world. She has nothing really left to lose. Her aunt won't throw her out and they won't starve. Her reputation wasn't wonderful to begin with, she says. And he wants to know why she wants to chat with Bonnet. And the way he expresses this mesmerizes her a bit. Quote, this I had to read a few times. It made me laugh. Quote, a slow smile grew on her lips, spreading into her eyes. I really like the way you talk, unquote. She hands him a piece of paper. It was the letter Jamie had dropped at her feet the last time they'd seen each other. In it, Jamie had implored her not to murder Bonnet. Quote, she was staring at the half-finished landscape on the easel as though it were a window, unquote. This is kind of symbolic of the state of her life, is it not? The landscape she'd imagined, whatever the circumstances she'd imagined, when she went through the stones, are gone. And the one that was here now is still being filled in. I thought that was interesting. So she wants to be free, whether Roger comes back or not. Now, this entire time, Osbert is kicking and is restless. She has to try to forgive Bonnet, and she thinks seeing him will help. So Lord John agrees. And before they part, as Summer was alluding to, Lord John cops a baby feel.
That sounds naughty.
So, fast forward to the garrison.
It's a warehouse, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's called a garrison first. The garrison is a whole thing, and the warehouse, I think, is underneath. But yeah, it's he's being held in the warehouse, but it is a jail cell, but it's called the garrison. Bonnet is being held in the cellar below the warehouse. A private hodgepile told Lord John he was in chains, and that's the only reason he'll think to allow Bree to see him alone. She recognized the name Hodgepile, and Brianna's appearance there, of course, was unexpected. Makes you think when Lord John arranged this little meeting, he obviously didn't advertise he was bringing an 8.5-month pregnant 6-foot-tall woman. They're led down to the cellar. She remembers where she'd heard the name Hodgepile. It was the man Ronnie Sinclair had described to Claire. The warehouse was crowded with kegs of pitch and barrels of brandy and rum. Hodgepile warns them that they must be careful of the fire. So be careful where you set this lantern. It's very moist in the air down in the cellar. Bonnet sees Brianna, recognizes her, and is startled. She hears the sound of chains clanking, and this gives her some courage. Oh, okay. That makes sense. He's locked up. He seemed smaller to her. Perhaps it was only that she was so much bigger. That was funny, Diana. She asks him if he knows who she is, and he says, I don't think you told me your name. He knows her face and a few other things. But yes, he recognizes her.
What an ass, man.
Dude. Was he an ass man?
There was a comma in there. You just clearly didn't hear it.
I heard it. I was just trying to make it funny. His stank wafts to her. and she vomits at the smell of him.
How awkward.
Very awkward.
Like being nasty. Pregnant. Like being pregnant isn't like
awkward enough in that area.
Bad enough. And you're trying to be like all badass and shit. And you just walk in there and you're just like, oh, I'm going to puke now because I inhaled too hard.
Inhaled your whatever. She gives her name. My name is Brianna Fraser. You attacked my father. Prepare to die.
Okay, Inigo. I think they'll probably cut the puking thing.
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, you don't need it. It's completely not needed. Not at all. She tells him that her parents are the ones he'd robbed after they'd saved his life. He says, yes. He was checking what she was saying. And he says, if she's come for the jewels, it was too late. One was sold, the other stolen, 4 months earlier. Then he notes that she got the ring back. And she says that she paid for that one. And she says she'll rest easier when he's dead. Now, something really tickles him. He laughs so hard that he cries. In the end, he says, so what do you want, darling? And the link she feels, this whatever she felt linked, however she felt linked with him, she feels is dissolved. She felt nothing. He could no longer bother her. He could no longer metaphysically touch her. Or abstractly, whatever, figuratively. She doesn't want anything from him. But she says that she came to give him something. And then she flashes Osbert.
Seriously, how big was this cloak?
I don't know, but it hit everything.
Because describing how large she is in every other scene and then having it be completely, completely disguised in a voluminous cloak. I mean, that seems... I mean, I don't know what the cloak looks like. I don't know if it is... If the dress she's wearing underneath is cut in such a way that it would conceal it as well. I don't know.
And after she flashes Osbert,
we'll have to wait
she
and see.
Tells him, yours. There's a new stillness behind his eyes. And she's ready to go. She says, if it makes dying easier to know there's something of you left on this earth, then you're welcome to the knowledge.
Yeah, but then doesn't he say some like douche comment? Like, you're not the first whore who tried to tell me.
Oh, yeah.
Who tried to fawn off a kid on me. Real classy. Real classy, Stephen Bonnet. Stay classy.
As she turns to go, Sergeant Murchison comes in through the hall and threatens her. She swings the lantern at his head and misses. Then Bonnet grabs her wrist. She tries to leave again, but is blocked by Murchison and sees, through the doorway, Lord John on the floor in the hall, unconscious. Murchison says, we need to go. I've taken care of Hodgepile and the fuses are lit. Wait, what? What? So what? The sergeant went. He has a gun, by the way. I missed that part. The sergeant went to club Brianna with the gun. And Mama Bear, on adrenaline, straight up grabs the barrel, grabs it from him, and smashes it. Him over the head, smashes his head, and swings again. And she's just going for it, and Bonnet stops her. Then time readjusted to normalcy. Bonnet said again that there's no time to waste. They have to get out. She says, no, she doesn't mean to kill him. He explains that the warehouse is laid with gunpowder and fuses. It is going to blow. He says he and Sergeant Murchison were part of a smuggling ring, and Hodgepile was onto it. So he was not in on it, but onto it. Like he was researching it, looking into it, snooping around to try and figure out what was going on. And okay, she says, well, what about Murchison? We can't leave him here. He's alive. He'll burn. This, for some reason, always sticks with me more than a lot of other pieces. Bonnet quickly solves this problem. He's like, fine. He goes past her, grabs the sergeant's own knife, and just slits his throat. I was like, well, that's problem solved. I was like, oh, okay. It's just like someone saying, oh, man, my finger hurts. And then goes and takes the ruler out of your hand and like smacks your other hand. So now your finger doesn't hurt, but your hand does. I mean, really? I mean, it solved the problem, kind of. But it was not good. So they're readying to go, and she starts to feel her belly contract. She's like, oh, no. She went to Lord John's body and tries to find a pulse point, and she finds a pulse. She started to drag him along the way. She looks at the architecture. Remember, she's an engineer, and deduces that they would likely be fine in this area because of brick. She begins to think that everything might be okay. And, you know, why try to rush out of here when we could just kind of stay here and weather this storm, if you will. She was going to administer first aid when Bonnet returns. He's like, get out of here. He's arguing with her. He knows the architecture of the place actually better than she does. He has been a smuggler here on and off for a while, you know.
Well, he's also been chained there.
Yeah, true. She won't go without Lord John, she says. Bonnet's like, ugh, fine. He picks him up and leaves, and she follows. Gun and lantern in hand, he's still bellowing for her. Woman, Brianna! I thought that was funny. She makes her way slowly out. Bonnet returns to drag her further. He brings them to the bank and they lie in the mud and long grass. Bonnet asks if she'll join him. He's such a romantic.
Right? Ugh. I have a ship. I'll take you with me.
Where I can rape you every night.
Right. Ugh. We can do that again.
He has a ship waiting upriver. Of course, remember, this whole thing is planned. I mean, you got to have time and money and someone on the inside. And that someone, of course, was Murchison. But you got to have a plan to, I mean, he wasn't really locked up. There was a plan. And Lord John, unfortunately, got in the middle of it. Well, Lord John and Brianna chose the wrong time, but whatever. This is the day they got in. This is the day they could book their appointment. And it just so happened to be on the day that they were going to be breaking out, literally breaking out. And part of that plan was for him to escape to his ship. She goes, no. He still lingers. He asks if it's true about the baby. And he puts his hand on her belly. She jerks away. Ugh, get away from me. And nods. He puts a finger in his mouth and pulls out a black diamond. Quote, that gleamed in her palm, the fire glowing red and bloody in its facets, unquote. That, of course, he says, is to for the maintenance of his child. The chapter ends. Gem, fire, blood. All that's missing is stone. Very cool. Michael M. writes, what is good about this chapter is that Lord John is still giving Bree company, being company for her. The bad is the return of Stephen Bonnet. The ugly is the spit take Lord John did when Bree informed him that she wishes to speak with Bonnet. Yes. Yes, you will. Erica B. writes, well, Bree wants to confront her attacker. She has come to terms with her situation and needs to put this thing to rest, and who can blame her? I'm not sure what I would do in her shoes. Bree is not concerned with her reputation, unlike Lord John, who is quite the opposite. I think this is because of her being brought up in the modern era where getting pregnant out of wedlock wasn't unheard of, I assume. I'm sure it was still looked down upon, but not the same way it is in the 18th century. And I just wanted to say, Erica continues, I hesitated to read and write notes on this section when I got to it because I know what happens. We arrive at the garrison where Bonnet is being held and the whole situation feels bad. Lord John had to bribe the guard to get in. There is pitch and turpentine, which we learn earlier on that is combustible with wood floors. I'm already stressed out. Am I the only one that is frustrated and annoyed with Bree for telling Bonnet her name and that the baby was his? Very specifically, yours? On the chopping block or not, forgiveness or not, why give him the satisfaction?
She made it pretty clear. And, I mean, she had a whole paragraph or two a monologue, if you will, as to why she was telling him. And this was not about Bonnet. This was about her.
Her. Huh.
This was about her not only forgiving him, but forgiving herself. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't think Erica's talking about that. She may not like the fact that Bree's going, but she's talking about go there, confront him. She doesn't have to mention the pregnancy, let alone say it's his to, I mean, She tells him and us why she did it. She's trying to give him something to maybe make his life a little easier in case it does. If it doesn't, then no harm, no foul. But I understand what Erica is saying. She's like, what did you get to gain to go there and to see him and to talk to him? She gained a lot, right? Their connection was dissolved. She forgave him. She can now go on with her life and not live and not worry as much or not have that inner hatred toward him. She, I believe, would have achieved that without Flash and Osbert. I'm saying that.
Hey, Flash and Osbert got her a black diamond.
Please don't make me spit my water on my computer.
Under the circumstances, had she not told him all of those things? Had she not told him all of those things, he might not have saved her.
Oh, yeah. I rescued her. That's true. That's true. I'm not dissing it. I'm just saying that part was not part of her bargain. I mean, it was obviously part of her bargain. She was going there with a plan. But I'm saying what Jamie convinced her to do was to forgive. That did not necessarily have to include the icing on the cake of this is your baby. I'm your baby mama. So I understand what Eric is saying. It's done. And yeah, she may not have been rescued and she may not have gotten the black diamond without it. But I don't think it was required for her to forgive him. It's all hitting the fan and Bree is making Bonnet talk about what is happening all the while trying not to blow up. As grief hits her about Lord John, she starts having contractions. I knew this wasn't going to be good.
But they were painless. They weren't like contractions. She wasn't like in labor. She was just having like Braxton Hicks.
After a few beats, Bree gets her wits back. She quickly examines the structural pieces. And as I said, she goes over and looks at the structure, considers the structure of the building. And then Bonnet returns and reminds her that the floor is made of wood. This is all so harrowing. I mean, for as terrible a person as Bonnet is, he did a nice thing by saving Lord John and Bree. I will give him that. And it was decent of him to give her the black diamond for the kids' maintenance. We leave this chapter perhaps left to believe this man really isn't all that bad, considering what he just did. Guess we'll just have to see about that.
Oh, no, I still think he's an asshole.
He's not a good dude.
For sure. Not a good dude. That was the end of part 11, people. We are in the home stretch, well, at least of this evening, but definitely also in the home stretch of this novel. We are on part 12, entitled Je T'aime. Or je t'aime, depending upon whether or not you actually speak French. Chapter 63, entitled Forgiveness. What?
As soon as I saw that word, you know what I thought? It's quiet uptown.
Je t'aime?
No, forgiveness, dude.
Oh, forgiveness. I was like, wait, what?
Summer. Come on. You're more of your knowledge of lyrics in Hamilton is better than mine. That should have clicked for you before me.
Well, I was thinking about a different section. I thought we were starting at the beginning. I thought you were actually going to be mocking my bad French.
Why would I mock? I don't mock your French. You mock your French.
Exactly. But you definitely laugh along with me and join in.
Exactly. I laugh along with you because you laugh. I don't laugh because you mispronounce it. I may correct you, but I don't laugh at you. It's when you say blah, 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 and then you go, ha, 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 that makes me laugh. And then you laugh, and I laugh. I don't laugh at you.
I've never said ha, ha, ha.
Oh, Summer. I don't do that. I know you don't. I'm just saying, when you make fun of yourself, I laugh. But I don't laugh at your pronunciation.
I was going to say, I've never done an impression of the chef from Little Mermaid.
You've never done one?
Not on our podcast.
You can do one now.
I will not.
Okay.
Forgiveness.
Forgiveness. Oh. Did we just say the same notes?
Real close.
We've never done that. I mean, I know why we did it.
Well, you can overlap them better when you go to edit it and you can find out if we sang the same notes.
All I'm saying is it didn't clash, Summer, okay, and it didn't harmonize. It was the same note. Holy spooky balls. That was pretty awesome. We should do that again, but not plan it. Okay. We are chapter 63, Forgiveness. Forgiveness. River Run, May 1770. Brianna is still pregnant and is upset that Jocasta wants to will her River Run. But she doesn't want it. She won't own slaves. Now, she'll allow her aunt's slaves to work for her, but she won't own them. Let's remember that Brianna has what? Priorities, levels, I don't know,
but Lord John sure had this whole thing planned out.
He sure did.
Like, hole in his head, he still had a plan.
Oh, that,
for
yes.
how the whole thing was going to happen. He's like, no, I'll give you money, I'll take your slaves, I'll free them, and then you will give me back my money, and then and then your slaves will be free, and you will have nothing to show for it.
Yeah, he breaks it down. You can't run a plantation the size of River Run without slaves, period. Arrangements could be made to free them, however.
He's clearly given it some thought. I mean, they have been engaged, quote unquote, for a while.
She says she'll listen to what Roger has to say. She promised that much, but she can't imagine him wanting to stay with her for love after hearing everything. And asks Lord John if he could. for a child that wasn't yours, she says. He says, for the sake of its parents, I expect I could. Quote, I was under the impression that I had been doing so for some time. Unquote. And he says his stepson is the son of his late wife's sister. She's less worried. Brianna is less worried about Roger and the baby than Roger and herself. She mentions how she didn't grow up knowing Jamie Fraser was her father, since after the Rising, they were separated. Claire married again, and she didn't find out otherwise until after Frank died. It was her parents who had had the trouble. She noticed the difference between her mother and Frank and her mother and Jamie. Worlds of difference. She thinks that she had what they have, even briefly. She says she can live without it, but she won't live with an imitation. And later, something's coming, I don't know what it is, but it is gonna be two riders. Two riders are coming up to River Run. One was her father, you can't hide the red hair. And the other, was it her mom, or Ian, or Roger? They're too far away to tell at this moment. Lord John asks her, please forgive your father. And she says she already has. And of course, well, we know this, ha ha ha, but they didn't. Of course, it's Claire. Claire is giving John a medical once over, and he does have one slightly enlarged pupil, and that's it.
It's not too bad considering that they did trepanation. Considering they drilled a hole in his head, the very thing that she was not successful doing last season on Outlander, no wonder she wants to take a look at it. Now, granted, she didn't ever do it in the books, but in season 3 of the Outlander series in the show, she failed at producing the same effect.
She confirmed that they had indeed found Roger, and that he'll be coming along a little later. Lord John says that he knows enough. Not everything, but most everything. He confirms that Dr. Fentiman had his skull. I wrote skill. Ha ha. Fun times. And she wants to look at it professional curiosity, and so she does. And when Lord John looks into the garden, he sees Brianna and Jamie in accord. Claire returns his sapphire to him.
Trephined.
Is that how it's pronounced?
I think it's trephined, and then it's trepanation. Trephined is T-R-E-P-H-I-N. So I think it's trephined your skull, but it's called trepanation. I've never seen a trepanation. But I do love that he's like, anything but the state of my bowels is... You can ask me anything except for about whether or not I pooped.
Apparently it's tree fine. Good Lord. Okay, let's look at the past tense. Tree find. Okay, it's not going to give to me. Anyway, it's a past tense. Past tense, simple past.
Tree found.
Tree find. Okay, I found a tree. Yeah, I tree find. So he tree find. It sounds so odd. He tree find his skull. No, he tree find his skull. Claire returns his sapphire to him, and Lord John says, jilted by God, and grins. Our adorable Marlo, her first time contributing. Welcome, Marlo. Thank you so much. Writes, I love the way this chapter begins. The ease with which George... Did you not hear what I just said?
Nope. How will I be doing that?
You missed it. Play it back some. I said the ease with which George...
I don't remember George being in that scene.
Me either. I don't even know if we have a George. Okay. The ease in which Lord John and Brianna speak with each other. It is a testament to the friendship they have forged over the weeks and months that they have been at Cross Creek together. Quote, that is the most stubborn woman I have ever met. Unquote. Brianna huffed into the room like a ship in full sail and subsided onto the love seat by the bed, billowing. Lord John opened one eye, bloodshot, under his turban of bandages. Your aunt? Who else? You have a looking glass in your room, do you not? His mouth curved, and after a reluctant moment, so did hers. End quote. I smile too, Marlow writes. This exchange is very reminiscent of a conversation that Lord John would have with Jamie. They are talking and joking with each other in a very familiar way, like people who have been friends for a very long time. And then, children being raised by someone other than their natural father is a common theme in the Outlander series, and that Diana has created many characters that have been in the same situation as Brianna's child may be. Family doesn't have to be determined by blood relation, but possibly also by love. Most obvious, Brianna herself, raised by Frank, Lord John and Willie, and of course, Jamie and Fergus. And while these were related, they were uncles raising their nieces or nephews. Reverend Wakefield and Roger, Uncle Lamb and Claire, and Colum and Hamish. Lord John explains his relationship with Willie and his love for his son. So you see, quote, so you see, there's no blood between us at all. And yet were any man to impugn my affection for him or to say he was not my son, I would call him out on the instant for it. Unquote. This love is the same that all the fathers above had for their children. A love and bond formed out of commitment, not necessarily blood. I love Lord John Grey, and one of the main reasons why I chose this chapter is because he was in it. His personality really shines through in this chapter and in his interaction with Brianna and Claire. The conversation at the beginning of the chapter between Lord John and Brianna is very entertaining, and the one between Claire and Lord John didn't disappoint either. They're growing closer, much to both of their dismay, it would seem, as they both take more liberties in the conversation and with each other than they normally take with people that they are not extremely familiar with. Lord John professing that he knows everything that is going on, and Claire opening his shirt without so much as a buy your leave. They are becoming friends, and it doesn't seem like either is too comfortable with it yet.
They're getting there. I think they're adorable together.
Totally, me too. Diana doesn't give a conversation between Lord John and Jamie, which I am sad about, but I know what their conversations are like, and it was time to develop Lord John's relationship with Brianna and Claire, which will continue to grow. But I do love that after all these years, Lord John still gets, quote, a small stab of anxiety, unquote, at the thought of Jamie coming up to see him.
I'm imagining the whole time, like, what is going to go through their brains when, like, Brianna's brains, I should say, when she finally realizes that Willie's her half-brother, considering she was engaged, even if it was faux engaged, to Lord John Grey for months. But Willie's not there. I don't know where Willie is, but he's not there. But he's there with her for months, and it's never mentioned. It never comes up, ever, until, you know, until it comes up in future books. I don't think that they ever adequately think about why she shouldn't be a little more shocked and a little more upset.
Well, the stuff I want to say, I can't. Marlow writes, I have always seen Lord John as a bit of a guardian angel for Jamie. He always seems to show up when Jamie needs him most. And Summer, what do we call this?
Grangey.
In Ardsmuir, when life was bleak for Jamie, he was there and offered him a friendship that helped him survive his time there, as well as his time after.
Reluctantly.
He saved him from being sent to the colonies and sent him to Hellwater instead, which in the end gave him Willie. Yeah, we thought, huh, well, I mean, he's thankful now, but at the time, he probably would rather have not had Willie. And now Lord John takes care of him as well. He even showed up in Jamaica and assisted when Jamie and Claire needed help. He is always there for Jamie. Now it just so happens that he can help with Brianna, and help he does. During their time together, he has befriended her, faked an engagement with her so that she could wait for Roger's return, helped her get closure with Bonnet, and now asked for forgiveness for Jamie.
And got a major concussion.
And his brain opened.
I think he's more than paid for whatever wrong he's ever done to Jamie.
Totally. I am not sure that Brianna would have gotten there by herself without Lord John there to confide in and to help guide her with her with friendship and love. She was so full of anger, and that is the truth. She was so full of anger when Jamie and Claire left to go look for Roger, but her time with Lord John changed her, and in the end, forgiveness. Michael M. Regarding the blackmail, this chapter begins with Brianna complaining about Jocasta's stubbornness, with which Lord John replies, you have a looking glass in your room, do you not? It's easy to understand why Lord John would consider using leverage to get Bree to do the right thing. Quote, I promised I'd listen to him first, unquote. She cast a narrow eye at Lord John, though I still say it's emotional blackmail. So much more effective than the other kind, he agreed. Almost worth a cracked pate to finally hold the whip hand on a Fraser. I knew by context what hold the whip hand meant, but I looked it up anyway to get a clearer meaning. It means to have the most power or influence in a particular situation or setting. Later on, Lord John again uses leverage when he brings up how Bree nearly got him killed so that she would forgive Jaime. Regarding Lord John's stepson, how many of you, when you read Lord John say, my son, my stepson, is in fact the son of my late wife's sister, imagined, my son, your half-brother, is in fact the son of my late wife's sister and your father.
Like I'm saying, yeah, she is going to be pissed down the road. She should be if she's not.
Okay, and then finally about Sprout. The chapter ends with Lord John being examined by Dr. Claire. And in this exchange, we see the seeds of friendship that began during the measles outbreak have taken root and thus Sprout. Megan P. writes, of course Brianna and Lord John would have developed an easy camaraderie. She is so much like Jaime. I am so glad they have had each other through this last few chapters and all the difficult things that have taken place. I just adore Lord John. His character becomes more lovely with each instance Diana writes him into the story. I always get a chuckle out of how English he is. And finally, Martina P. writes, my favorite part of this chapter is that we get another glimpse into the relationship between Bree and Lord John, who proves over and over what a lovely gentleman he truly is. I love how open they are with each other. It is really rather unique. She reveals her dreams and fears to him and shares her observations on the differences between her mother's marriages. Although he is slightly discomfited, he delivers my favorite line in this chapter. Quote, do you know how rare such a thing is?
Did he just get Italian? Sort of...
Stop it.
Such a thing is?
Stop it, you tracker. Do you know how rare... Stop it.
Go ahead.
Stop it, Summer.
You did it, not me.
Do you know how rare... Let her go. Dun, 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 dun. Let me go. Do you know how rare such a thing is? That peculiar sort of mutual passion, unquote. Of course. Brianna's response to this question is just as impressive. I also love how he talks about his son, Willie, and being able to love a child that is not of his by blood. Lord John is also very frank and bold with Claire.
I don't think we can ever use frank as an adjective for this book series.
But the way he treats Bree is different yet. I can't quite put my finger on it. Only the feelings of jealousy he has toward Claire do not extend to Bree. So this must be the difference in the relationships he has with women close to Jamie's heart. Another wonderful moment. That's actually a very good... we could like do an episode on that, or at least a half an episode. Like that is interesting. He's always going to have, I agree their friendship is blooming and it, you know, without giving a huge spoiler, they definitely, their friendship grows throughout the rest of the books. We can say that much, but it will always have with it. He will always be jealous of her. It may not come out in an evil, mean way as it maybe once would have, but, or in an ugly way, I should say. But it's always there because he will pretty much forever be in love with Jay. He just always will be. That's just since he was, 16? Well, I don't think he had feelings then, but definitely had feelings when he was at the governor of Arsmere. Martina P. continues. Another wonderful moment in this chapter is when Claire examines Lord John and inquires about the status of his bowel movements. And he responds with great dignity, quote, I decline to say, unquote. This is just priceless and made me laugh out loud. I also thought it funny that he never doubted for a moment that Claire could not have been one of the two arriving writers. Of course, because it's Jaime. I was relieved, she continues, that Bree finally managed to forgive Jaime, and I love the fact that Lord John made her promise. However, I would have preferred to witness their reconciliation, especially since Jaime actually did not live up to his promise to bring Roger back to her. He might be safe and out of imprisonment, but still, he is away. This was a very short chapter, but full of little gems.
And that was chapter 63, and we will be finishing this evening with chapter 64, entitled Bottom of the Ninth.
Bree is finally in labor. Claire is trying to use the analogy of baseball. Not trying. She uses the analogy of baseball to talk her through the labor. Jaime is there, trying to support her in ways that he can, and he actually wants to leave. He's like, yeah, I probably shouldn't be here. Brianna says, don't leave me. You said I wouldn't die. If you stay, it will be all right. I won't die, unquote. Claire tells her, you won't die. And then she says, if I do, don't leave me. Don't. So what's a dad to do? I mean, of course, he's pretty much has to stay now, because otherwise she'll be scared. And of course, he wants her to be safe and the baby to be safe. So for the meantime, what they can do is walk to help bring on the labor. So Jaime walks her. Jocasta, just as they're walking and pacing, Jocasta is pacing on her terrace as well. And Betty looks in, and Phaedra too. An hour later, Bree says she wants to lie down. They get her out of her gown, and she's in just her shift. And as Claire is feeling about, Bree calls out for her daddy. Jaime is there in an instant. Jaime tries to help calm her and keep her mind off of the things, off of certain things, by telling her stories. The pains are growing closer together, and suddenly Bree starts to push. And then we get the Diana description of how she, Claire, helps oil up her daughter to avoid tearing. I mean, I get it. I do. But, oh, Lordy, could you imagine your mom helping you in that way?
But my mom's not a midwife or a doctor.
No, me either. The baby is being born. Jaime asks, is it a boy? That's his first question.
Claire Seriously. Says,
I hope so. It's the ugliest thing I've ever seen. God help it if it's a girl. And a little boy is born. Phaedra runs out to share the news. Brianna is glowing and Jaime is crying, talking to her in Gaelic and kissing her just behind the ear. I thought that part was a little bit weird. I'm sure it looked fine, but I'm like, wait, you gotta like, that's something you do like to your romantic partner. But okay.
He also kissed Ian full on the mouth when he left him at the Tuscaroran village. So
that's the thing. He was saying goodbye forever.
This could be a Gaelic hello. I don't know.
He would have done it to other people before.
It's like an Oklahoma hello. Little musical theater for you.
Claire realizes that she's crying when Brianna begins to nurse the baby. Later, Jaime kisses Claire and tells her that she did well too, Granny. Now, it's too early to tell if the baby will be dark or fair, and she tries to explain recessive genes, actually genetics at all, to Jaime. And, that's not going over so well. They won't know until the baby is old enough to actually resemble someone, and even then, it's not 100%.
Mm-hmm.
Quote, if I didn't ken his father, at least I'm sure who his grandsire is. Unquote. And as she's falling asleep, Claire, she wonders if Frank knows that Bree has a son. Leanne F. writes, there was nothing more American than baseball when Claire and Brianna were living in Boston in the 50s and 60s. Claire's description of childbirth being like baseball provides a humorous moment for the Frasers as Brianna is fretting about giving birth. Jamie's attempts to interpret the baseball references provide the women a much-needed opportunity to laugh. Brianna fears that she will die since she is so far away from any modern hospital if something goes wrong. But as Claire tries to reassure her, death in childbirth in colonial America was not as risky as we might assume. Quote, the fact was that there wasn't a hell of a lot you needed to do at a normal birth, and not the hell of a lot you could do if it wasn't. Unquote. And Leanne F. provides a few sources that we'll include links in the show notes about childbirth throughout history. One from horacemann.org, women in colonial America regarded childbirth as a frequent and burdensome female event. A woman spent a significant portion of her life bearing and raising children from the time she was married, typically at 22 years of age, until about 40 years old. The average woman had 7 to 8 children, giving birth to another child every 15 to 20 months. Childbirth was an event shared by the female community and supervised by a midwife. As such, a woman's companions enabled her to bear more advantage, and their cheerful conversations supported her spirits and inspired her with confidence, unquote. The mortality rate for mothers was high compared to today's standards, yet low compared to contemporary standards in Great Britain. For example, rural Maine midwife Martha Ballard recorded only 5 maternal deaths per 1,000 in the 1790s, while London had at the same time averaged 27.5 deaths per 1,000 births. Although American colonists did not document the exact causes of death, even if every woman in the 17th century Plymouth who died during her childbearing years died because of labor complications, the birth was still successful 95% of the time. That's actually pretty impressive. This chapter was very bittersweet to me, Leanne F. continues. Finally, Jamie Fraser gets to be present at the birth of a child, not his own, but at least his grandchild. It makes me remember the other times when Claire was giving birth and Jamie was unable to be there because he was imprisoned or 200 years away in time. In fact, this entire episode, or chapter, gives us a chance to spend time with the Fraser family, Claire and Jamie and their child, Brianna, in an achingly intimate and heartwarming way. I could not have even imagined such a possibility at the beginning of Dragonfly and Amber when Claire and Brianna are knocking on Roger's door and are so, so far away from Jamie. Brianna's insistence that Jamie stay with her while she goes through this major life event makes me like her more than at any other time in the past. Brianna has truly come to value Jamie and his role as her father. She recognizes and accepts that Jamie Fraser will do everything in his power to ensure that she and Claire are safe. And Jamie is definitely in his element once Claire encourages him to treat Brianna like a horse about ready to give birth. That made me laugh. And I can't imagine anything more delightful and soothing to the soul than having Jamie Fraser tell you stories to take your mind off an unpleasant situation. I think each Fraser did brawly, as Jamie says, of his two women. And it is only fitting that Claire should extend a loving thought to Frank at the end of the chapter as she and Jamie are reveling in their good fortunes as Granny and Grandpa Fraser. Claire is secure in the love of her family and thankful for the blessing of a grandson and Brianna's safe passage through childbirth. She can reach out to Frank somewhere in the vast cosmos and offer hope that he knows his daughter is now a mother in her own right. Bottom of the ninth. The title of this chapter makes me think that this is the last-ditch effort for Roger to show up and save the day with his arrival. He doesn't, though, so this is a bittersweet as well. Gotta say that Roger lost some points with me here. He should have been with Brianna. His need for taking some time to make his decision whether to stay or go back to his own time seems a selfish act here for someone who ventured all the way for love of Brianna in the first place. I know his terrible ordeal with Jamie and Ian and then the Native Americans has made him rethink his decision to follow Brianna to the past, but he takes far too long to decide what he needs to do. Jamie would have been there in a shot.
We don't know. There's many things we don't know. We don't know how long after Jamie and Claire arrived that Brianna went into labor. We don't know. Well, we just don't know. I mean,
we know it. The only thing we know is it takes about 6 weeks to get from where they were, Snake Town, to River Run. Yeah, that's all we know. But like you said, we don't know how long it took Brianna to go into labor. Could have been a week, could have been a month. I don't know.
It could have been one night. They could have arrived. And if he'd taken one day,
he still would have been late. Yeah.
Like one day, he still would have been late. So, I mean, we don't know. Yes, it would have been awesome if he'd been like last ditch, showed up and just ran in the room just in time to catch the baby. But that's not what happened, and that's okay.
Lisa T. writes, the title of the chapter is a reference to the game of baseball, which reminds us of Claire and Bree's 20th century past and memories of Frank. Bree remarks that, quote, at least baseball games you get to drink beer and eat hot dogs, unquote. Jamie, clearly not understanding, asks if Bree wants a beer. Claire says that alcohol wouldn't be good for the baby. Another contrast between giving birth in different centuries. A few minutes later, Jamie suggests that he should go, like a typical 18th century man. Bree begs him to stay, fearing that she will die. When I first read this, I thought that Brianna was just being dramatic, but after reflecting on the other births in the book to date, I understand her fear. In Outlander, we saw Jenny give birth, and all was well, but in Dragonfly, we see Claire nearly die after losing Faith. Claire also says that she nearly died giving birth to Bree, but didn't, thanks to the 20th century hospital. In Voyager, we see Geneva die after giving birth to Willy. Giving birth is dangerous, no matter what the century. Bree's giving birth ties together all the previous books in the series. It is really beautiful that Jamie gets to share the birth of his grandchild with Claire and Bree, especially since he wasn't with Claire both times that she gave birth. While he did see Willy soon after he was born, he was not present at his birth. Jamie being with Bree and telling her stories as she labors is so moving because of all the heartbreak he has had surrounding the births of his children. There is something deeply intimate about Claire helping Bree deliver her baby. This is such a tender and powerful moment. Claire was there with Bree when Bree was a baby. She cared for her as Jamie could not. Jamie didn't know Bree as a baby. This moment for Claire embodies exactly who she is, mother, wife, and healer. Bree's giving birth is an intersection of so many stories, and for Claire, it is a culmination of all the different lives that she has led. This moment transcends time. The scene ends with Brianna safely giving birth to a boy. This scene is also one of the happiest moments in Jamie's life and in the series. After so much tragedy and grief, Jamie finally has his family together and safe. Later, Jamie asks Claire about the baby's coloring, trying to determine what the father might be. Then, in an echo of faith, he mentions that he counted the baby's fingers. Claire tries to explain genetics, but gives up. Claire goes on to quote one of Frank's favorite sayings, "Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof." This statement reminds us of the 20th century again and Frank, Bree's other father. Claire whispers to Frank's ghost, asking if he knows Bree had a son. Quote, "There was no answer, but peace came gradually over me in the quiet of the night, and I fell at last over the edge of dreams." Unquote. Herself has written that DOA is about home and family. This chapter is the heart of that. Interestingly, this is the fourth book in the series. The fourth sign of the zodiac is Cancer, which symbolizes home, family, and parenthood. And finally, Marlo R. writes, "Brianna is having a baby! This is a special yet terrifying time for Jamie. He's finally getting the family he has always desired and deserved. He's actually doing the things that an expectant father would do." This is very similar to how Claire feels about Jamie when they are together, and when he is near, they are safe. Brianna is beginning to feel the same comfort and protection from Jamie. And finally, Marlo writes, "Although Jamie is Bree's bio dad, and we are all happy to have them reunited, Frank did help raise her for all those years, and Bree does still love him. I am sure that Frank was missed by both Claire and Bree in some way on this day, and to me it was a great reminder that he is still loved, gone, yet not forgotten."
All right. And that was chapter 64. Join us next week when we will be... We're finishing next week, you guys. I can't even believe it. We are starting with chapter 65 next week, and we won't stop until we're done. No stop till Fiery Cross. We are so close, but still so far. And how many days until? We can't say days, but the weeks before we premiere season 4 are getting shorter and shorter.
When this episode comes out on Sunday, it'll be 2 weeks.
2 weeks, guys, 2 weeks. Well, and as always, if you'd like to join us to continue the conversation, please join us on our Facebook page at www.outlanderpod.com/group.
So, as we mentioned earlier, we would love to, speaking of continue the conversation, can you imagine having this conversation in Scotland? If you guys would like to learn more about our upcoming Pod Abroad in 2019, go to podabroad.com. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next and final episode in the Drums of Autumn read-along episode.
Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.